science and data. So as I tell my team, there's two things we bank on, right? It's math and science, because science we can prove, to the best of our ability, and math never lies. So we've taken the data and decided what type of personalities and skill sets are necessary to be able to do what we do every day. Finding people that have PhDs to come and work for our organization is all about people who are committed to something. So when we go and we look at doing a move, sometimes, especially for government agencies, that's a 5-year commitment. Somebody has to be committed. And the one reason why I got the opportunity at the Pentagon is because people saw my commitment. They didn't like the fact that people would come in, stay for a year or two, and leave because all the institutional knowledge left with them. So some of the people that we look for are those that have tenure, right? Those that have committed to something, that love it. Knowing numbers is a really big part of doing work with us, because we always control our clients' budget. And when I say control, I'm saying that loosely, which means they depend on us to make sure that we don't exceed the budget. And believe it or not, while we're in the moving industry, now our firm really does span out and do construction management. So if we don't have a strong hold or the finance of that project, it really does fail. So just to bring that full circle for you, for us, finding the right people is all about matching the right people with the job that we're doing, looking for committed, loyal people that demonstrates to us that they're in it for the long haul. That way we can tell our clients, hey, you're getting people that have more years of experience than what our competitors may ask for, or other people in the industry. We're not going to call them competitors because they're all friends. So we're going to call and say that we want to look for people who, again, are dedicated, that we can say we're a concierge level type service. We're going to be here for you, and we're going to research and give you all the information that you need to make sure your job that you give us is the most successful.
Obviously, you have a VIP client list, and I know you don't want to drop names, but categories of occupations and businesses in which your clients represent.
Okay, my favorite is government, and I say favorite is government because it's the most secure. My next favorite is the MBA. I like clients in the MBA. I like those clients, and I gotta say it, because they always trust us the most. It feels like they just kind of give us a lot of autonomy. And another client of ours is in the music industry. So they span the music industry, the government, commercial. So we have some clients that are running Fortune 500 companies, CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, you know, the ones that have their own helicopters. Okay. And private planes. So we do work for those guys as well.
Now, when a client comes to you, what are some of the things that you all do prior to assisting them in moving, other than the location in which they're moving to?
Oh, my goodness. It is research. So moving is about change management. It's a psychological change, right? Because there are three things that most people don't like, which is death, divorce, and moving. So before we can even get involved and when I want to say take your case, almost like a lawyer, right? So before we decide to take your case, we got to understand the psychology of it. Because even if someone is building a brand new house, they want to move. So if we deal with a residential client, is, you know, let's dream for a moment, you and I. How about that? So we're going to build a 20,000 square foot house. It's beautiful. It has, you know, it's sitting on the water. It has everything. That client still dreads moving into it. It's the packing, right? It's the packing. It's the child who just got, you know, a 2-story closet that is going to leave some of their friends. So, and then if it's a government or a commercial client, it's the client that is the employee that doesn't want to leave because they found their favorite Starbucks. And it's like, what am I going to do? How am I going to do this? So before we take on any client, we really do research. We want to understand why. You know, why now? Why the move? What can we do to really assist you? What's your pain points? What's keeping you up at night? So before we respond to a request for a quote, we want to do some research and make sure we're going to really be able to give you that concierge level, no worry zone that we believe that you should expect during a move-in experience.
Having done this for a better part of 2 decades, what do you know now that you didn't know once you began your business in 2007, 2008?
Oh my goodness, how much time do we have?
We got time.
Oh my goodness, it's so much. I started off really strong. I did what I learned in school. I went and got, an accountant, a banker, a good team, a lawyer. I did those things. Those are textbook. What I didn't really understand is the level of work-life balance that didn't really exist. Now, I'm built for it, right? So, yeah, I have broad shoulders that I can carry sleeping only 4 hours a night versus the 8 that I was accustomed to prior to starting entrepreneurship. But some of the things that I just didn't understand and what I would do differently is I would find a stronger team. When I say stronger, I don't mean that they weren't talented. What I mean is maybe a bigger team. So maybe I should restate that. Just a bigger team to help support me so I could get some more rest. I found myself probably about a decade ago almost getting tired, and I had to rejuvenate. So I had to plug myself back in. So I would really try to figure out a better way of taking care of my health to be able to do that. I think I chose the right field. So I know some people would go, would you do something different? No. And I'm going to keep expanding, and I'm going to keep expanding my business so that all of my services are complementary to one another. So I wouldn't say that, but I would say that I would go big or go home. I would do things with a lot less risk averse so that I could have hit some of the goals that I had maybe 5 years ago versus just attaining them today in 2025. Now, that's my small list.
Okay.
You know, I wrote a book, and it was talking about being successful and some of the things that I would change. And it's always been circled around, if I had time, if I had a glass ball, I could do that. But I will tell you the best thing that I ever did was say yes when I was asked to do it.
How has you gone about reinvesting in your business to sustain its success?
Carefully. I have been careful. I'm very frugal. I have a great accounting team. And the one thing that I find challenging is if I sit in a room and not disclosing what room that is, and someone says, well, I got to ask my CFO. I have to ask my accountant, not me. I'm logging onto my computer and I'm answering the questions. I've always paid very close attention to my finances. And for the first 10 years of my business, I've always reinvested that money. It was so bad, even this year, Ernst & Young came and said, why don't you pull some of that money out? And I said, because now I want to open another side of my business. It's okay. I'm okay. So for me, reinvesting it is understanding that I had a big picture. And I do want to say, I had a wonderful mentor. He's my cousin. And he was the first entrepreneur in our family. And he's always really told me to keep an eye on what the end goal was. And my end goal, I always knew I wanted to create a legacy business that I could hand down to my two daughters. And to do that, I had to keep inventing. And to keep inventing, I knew I had to keep the cash flow to be able to do that. So how did I figure it out and figure out, what to do? A good team, acute attention, Goldman Sachs, Ernst & Young, Harvard, right? All of those things always made you go back and look at your balance sheets and figure out really where you were and make sure you were cutting expenses and spending the money in the right places. And I also take the right contracts. I think that's really important and very understated. I don't take a contract just to take a contract, right? I am a for-profit business. I take a contract that is going to yield good result, make everybody feel good when doing it, but also make the money so I can pay the people, keep doing the marketing, keep the lights on.
This is In Black America. We'll be back with more of our conversation in a moment.
Hi, I'm Lori Gallardo, and I have just one question for you. What is the darkness to you?
Dark to me now is fear.
What is dark to you? It seems like a morbid question at first, but some answers may surprise you.
Dark is actually inspiration to me, I think. As weird as that sounds.
That's the idea behind my new podcast, SPF 1000 Vampire Sunscreen, where I have conversations with all kinds of people from all walks of life about what they define as the darkness. You can find SPF 1000 Vampire Sunscreen at KUTX.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Anita R. Conway, founder and president of Proven Management, LLC. That was going to take me to my next question. Obviously, you all are hands-on, and you have a select clientele. How do you decide on what contracts to take, and is there a limited number of contracts that you all can take considering the size of the company?
Yes, there's always a limit, right? And oh, there always should be a limit, because the idea is that you want to give the best of what you have. So there is a capacity room, and our capacity is always about what my team can do. So I talk about me, but it's really this team that helps me every day make those decisions. You know, we'll sit around my table and, you know, I'll ask the team member, hey, what do you think about this? And one of my team members will go, no, I think we're too busy in the month of June. We have to pass on it. So for us, it really is knowing what we're trying to deliver and keeping our mission in mind as we decide what contracts we're going to take. Again, the capacity of the room really makes a difference. And there are now, you know, especially commercial clients, they'll come back and say, well, what's your capacity? You know, how many current contracts do you have? What can you do? And it's always an easy question. You know, I remember when I brought some team members on, when I started expanding my executive team, they didn't really understand it. And I said, well, that's a good question. You know, like, tell them you can do it. I was like, no, but it's a good question. Because if we don't have the people, if we burn those people out, then it goes back to we don't have the talent. If we take on too many, we'll fail. And I don't know about you, but I like getting the A on my paper. So we look at it. We look at everything that we have. We make a very strong, unanimous decision. It really does have to be unanimous that we're going to take things. And then the projects that we take have to deliver and support the mission that we said that we do.
You mentioned about government work. How do you all navigate the security concerns in that process?
It's not easy, okay. Right? It's not easy. It's ever changing. You know, my head is spinning since 2025 has started. It's really not easy. But I think part of it is that you got to understand that that's a responsibility. It's not optional, right? So you grab a hold of it. You find someone, and if it's not on your staff, it's your attorney or a contracts outsourcing company. Nowadays, they're because of the security requirements and just the general compliance requirements altogether. You have people that will support you on that. But we have a team that is dedicated to security and compliance on my team that really does focus on, you know, what we have to do, what regulations are coming out. And I gotta admit, my legal team is amazing. They send us emails with ever-changing things to keep us abreast. And then a shout out to my IT team, which is not part of my company. They're outsourced company and my neighbor, but he does a great job in letting me know certain things like the CMMC that's coming out, making sure we're compliant. So I really do it with a group of people, but it is forefront. So that is a topic for conversation at every executive level meeting that we have. What changes are there? How do we keep up? And I just read, right? I just read. I look at everything. I will even find it on X and Instagram if I have to, but I'm going to make sure that we are in compliance, both security-wise and everything else that comes out.
Anita, before we run out of time, are there any boxes that must be checked before and after each assignment?
For me, okay, so customer service is my most important deliverable. And as long as that's checked, everything else falls into place. And I know that sounds like a storybook, but that's really how not only myself, but the team members to support me feel. Our box that we check is customer service. If we can deliver good customer service, which means we're making the money that we need to make on the project, we got the right team members on the project fits our mission, we're golden.
Speaking of golden, obviously you all have developed some groundbreaking concept to set new standards and benchmarks for the industry. How does that make you feel?
Out of body. Okay, is this really me? So, you know, in research, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was a C student. So I am really a Cinderella story. If I can do it, you can do it. So to look back and look at where we are today and look at, I can see the future. I see what we have forecast. I see what people are coming and wanting to be a part of my team. It is really a remarkable experience. Some people are going to Mars, but I found Mars here right on Earth.
I heard that. Obviously, you've been recognized for your award-winning work. Are there any particular accolades in which you hold dear?
My first one is the Small Business Person of the Year. That I literally, don't laugh at me, cried when I got it. I thought it was a joke. I was like, is this real? Because it came as an email. Because when the Small Business Administration did that, they have everything about me. They, you know, they're the government. They know my finances. Everything about me. So to win that was wonderful. I is probably one of the most coveted awards that I've ever gotten. I'm not going to say my second, but another one is the Ernest Young Winning Women. To be one of 23 in North America? Oh, my goodness. I still pinch myself. And I got awarded last year. But I think probably the award that I love the most is the one that my team granted me, which is Chief Empathetic Officer. And what makes me covet that is that I know that they believe in me and that they believe in my vision. And with that, I know now the sky is truly the limit.
What are some of the best lessons you learned thus far as an African-American female?
And here we go with that question, right? That has so many answers to it. The best lesson I've learned would be patient, be transparent, and be a steward to even those that you believe can't teach you anything. Because everybody has a story to tell and has a lesson to provide.
Where would you like to see proven management maybe 5 or 10 years down the road?
Well, in my daughter's hands.
Okay.
Uh-huh. So my daughters need to take it over, or my employees need to take it over. But as far as the company, in all seriousness, we just opened up the true residential division. So before we would do residential only for VIPs. But now we're going to open it up to a broader span. And that just came from my personal moving experiences over the last year or two. So I like to see us doing a lot more of that. And I like to see a part of what we do actually be taught in schools. So project management is now a curriculum that you can study. I'm in the Washington, D.C. area, so Morgan State University, for example, has a project management discipline. I like to see what we do or some of our people being invited to be able to teach some of the MOVE management, which is actually project management. As far as the company, hey, listen, I have millions more to make and hundreds more employees to hire. So watch out. We're on the third floor. We're getting to the 45th. I got 5 good years to do it. 10 strong years if I push.
You talk about employees. How many individuals currently make up your company?
Right now we have 56 full-time employees and 16 or so part-time employees and a host of other people that help out.
That's an enormous undertaking. How important is for you to navigate this industry knowing that 56 plus individuals is depending on you and your company for their livelihood?
You know, it goes back to not sleeping. Right? Like it is a task to want to care, right? Like you want to care. And, I don't like making mistakes, and I don't like making mistakes because people depend on me. So we think about us being parents. So I'm a disclosed mother too, right? And when they were younger, they depended upon me to do everything for them. If mom didn't pay the electric bill, we were all out with lights. And so I carry that burden humbly and proudly for every one of my employees. If I don't do something right, then, you know, what they get up every morning and they come to work because they love coming to work. if I make a mistake, now they're doing something different. So it's a task, but it's really one that I wouldn't change if someone said, I'm going to give you a crystal ball. I'm going to give you everything that you've ever achieved, but you just have to do it by yourself. I would still say, I want every one of those employees. And oh, by the way, I need about 100 more. So I'm pushing to be able to improve the lives of others while improving the life of myself through them.
How has technology played an increasingly important role in logistics?
Well, it's a big deal, right? Because technology has played an increasing role just in the world. So as one thing, well, see, my team might disagree with me because I can be very handwritten things. I need the old technology. But the one thing that I found that my team has done is really being able to do real-time communication with people, because that's half of what we do. Remember, customer service? So being able to utilize different platforms helps us. Being able to develop, right now my team is trying to develop an app that's going to help our jobs be a lot easier, but that's helping to push the information out to our clients in real time. So technology, yeah, I don't have much more to say on that one, because I just feel like I am in the old ages still wanting paper and pen, but I know that technology has really helped my team communicate quicker, faster, keep our clients up to speed and feel much better about their moving process when they can track a truck.
So, Danita, when you're not running this company, what are some of your other activities?
Sleep. I love to travel. I love to travel. It's not so much about traveling to vacation, more so traveling to see. I believe that different cultures, going back to my international business minor at Temple, different cultures bring in different experiences. So I love to do that. I love to spend time with my family. That makes me really happy. And come 2025, I'm taking up tennis.
I got you. I like to ask, this is one of my final questions. Knowing what you know now, what would you tell your 14-year-old Danita?
Stop skipping school and pay attention in class. I would tell her, you have no idea how much fun you're about to have. And to feel really good about your youth and the decisions that you're making, because the decisions that you're making will yield you something. So I would give her a crystal ball.
I understand. Any final comments, Danita?
It's been fun. It's been fun. I wish we had more time. I have so much more to say.
Well, we have to come back and do this again.
I would love to. You have been such a pleasure to talk to, and I am so humbled that you were willing to talk to me and hear a little bit about my story.
Danita R. Conway, founder and president of Proven Management, LLC. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
Welcome.
All right, everyone. This is our mini pod. It's Native Land Pod. Welcome home, y'all. I'm Angela Wright with Tiffany Cross and Andrew Gillum. And today we are talking about a lot of stuff in this mini pod.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I want to talk about, because we got some serious stuff to get to, but in our main podcast,
this was serious.
Angela sent an email that I shouldn't have looked at because I should be focused on you guys, but I just glanced down because it popped up on my computer. Angela was invited to appear on MSNBC, and she responded, and I'm going to read that email for our
Tiff is viewing so audience. Nasty.
Hi, blank. I won't say the person's name. Hi, blank. I was devastated by the untimely and unfortunate dismissal of my friend Joy Reid. I will not likely be making any appearance on MSNBC in the foreseeable future. Thank you, Angela Rye.
I said thank you for the offer.
Thank you for the offer, which if you read Black Women Speak is f- you.
No, it wasn't. Not offer, to her.
Fine.
More like kickbox, yeah, barefoot.
Pretty much, whichever, however you want to say it. But why I found this so hilarious is because the temerity of them to even ask. It's like, why would
she be asking?
Clearly, because she said, hey, following up on the request.
I was trying to be nice by not responding.
Yeah, no. But I just think that is, I don't know what to do with myself because I spent my whole career building this and it is a really a dying industry. So I don't even know what to do with myself, but it's like y'all killed yourself. You know, the ratings have not been what they were since Joy left.
And Joy's killing it. It was such a dumb decision. I just want to say to Joy that we offer ourselves up to appear on your show, Joy, but we, I don't think any of us are going on MS. And I just, you know, for me, I could have included Tiff too, but I wanted them to know. I wanted to bring up Joy in this moment because, of course, Joy just happened, and we had a full-on boycott that began shortly after, right when we really learned of her dismissal. And with Tiff, we didn't have that because Joy was still on, and so I think we were trying. I wasn't watching weekends, but I definitely, you know.
We would say don't watch except for Joy show.
Yeah.
You know, like tune in to Joy show.
Yeah.
And now it's like you ain't gotta watch anything. And there are people there who I love dearly. Eamon Moyadine, I think he's amazing. Ali Velshi, amazing. Mm-hmm. So there are wonderful people over there. But and they have their righteous frustrations too, I'm sure. So I just want those individuals to know we see you, we hear you, we feel you, and thank you for continuing to speak truth to power. On the network. And they lost Mehdi too. Mehdi Hasan, who was brilliant.
He'll be on with us soon too.
Katie Fang.
Mm, me and Katie Fang got into it online because I thought she was saying something about Tiff she wasn't saying. It was a whole
remember.
Thing. But shout out
to
Katie.
Well, I didn't like her tweet either. But I like Katie is such a supporter and so
she
sweet and nice and
wonderful.
Assistant. Yes.
She cleared it up.
So it was all a misunderstanding.
And I didn't know she was helping Andrew. I don't know where I was in it. And I was like, oh, she got
Yeah, she was my lawyer.
I don't remember that part. Yeah. But I definitely am grateful to her.
I was mad at everybody. So when I saw Katie, I was like, what? How dare she? I didn't know who to trust.
Yeah.
And, like who was betraying me because so many people were betraying me at the time. So anyway, I just wanted to share that with the audience just so y'all know. So y'all know it's real. And shout out Angela.
Yeah, I'm not going on these shows if they're not going, you know, I'm just, I like, honestly, I don't even understand the point. I think there are other ways to cut through right now. And I am almost singularly focused on figuring out how to uplift independent voices, that can be guided by the strength of their convictions. And I think to that point, right. Where we're not seeing these days as much is earnest conversations around the violence that is ensuing against Black bodies all throughout this country, some with the blessing of the Department of Justice, some at the behest and the pushing of ICE, the Immigration Customs Enforcement. We had just on my show on Tuesday, my live show was with Mildred Pierre, who is the wife of Rodney Taylor, who was detained in January and is still in ICE custody because of a crime that he allegedly committed and was pardoned for when he was 16 years old. A paraplegic, not paraplegic, but he has, what's it called when you, prosthetics. He has prosthetic limbs. Mm-hmm. They accused him of jumping into a window, stealing a stereo and jumping out of the window. He had a wood foot at the time. And so they pardoned him of this. ICE still detained him and wants to deport him back to Liberia. Some of y'all know the history of Liberia. If you don't, we put links in for you in the podcast on Tuesday. So you can understand how ridiculous this is. Rodney has a hearing August 12th that I will be attending. I'm, of course, inviting my co-host and anybody who wants to join us. We cannot let this stand. Tiff and Andrew and I.
Where is it?
Oh, that's important. It's in Georgia. And we'll make sure we send additional details. There's a GoFundMe. But my point in saying this is the violence on Black bodies is happening at the federal level, the state level, the local level. The Jacksonville sheriff is currently investigating an incident that happened against William McNeil Jr. In Jacksonville, Florida in February. And some of us are just learning about it. I want to give y'all a trigger warning to my co-host, to those who are watching at home, and even the listeners. This is not easy to hear or see, but we need to be aware. Let's roll the clip.
Yes, sir.
Is there a reason why you're popping the door open like that?
I don't have a window that works. Is there a reason that you're pulling me over?
Yeah, absolutely there's a reason why I'm pulling you over. For one thing, inclement weather, you don't have your lights on. Two things, you're not wearing your seatbelt.
It's daylight. Three? I don't need the lights. And it's not weather. It's not raining.
Oh, this is inclement?
It's not raining.
Okay, I'm not arguing with you. I'm telling you why I'm pulling you over. Give me your driver's license, registration, proof of insurance.
No, call your supervisor. Why?
Excuse me?
Call your supervisor. Why did you pull me over?
37, 37, 35. I'm fucked with the driver. I've already told you.
Why did you pull me over?
Step out of the vehicle.
No.
Step out of the vehicle. For not for the 9-4, the driver just slammed the door and locked it.
All right, go for it. Exit the vehicle now. Exit the vehicle. Show me your hands.
Here.
I'm here. What's your reason, sir?
Step out.
What is your reason?
Step out now.
All right.
Get on the ground.
No, don't. Get on the ground. Put your hands behind
your back. Hands behind your back.
Ooh, so there is another angle of this video.
There is where you can see.
Yeah. Him. And I almost want to, I know that was traumatizing enough, but I almost want to play that too. Maybe we can,
Wait,
we can,
please.
Okay. I was going to say we can insert it in post, but I want to,
I think I that angle is really
yeah,
important.
Yeah, I agree with you, Andrew. It's a completely different experience. I wanted the full video, but now I understand why it was on Fox 11 because they wanted to make sure that we heard about the marijuana as if that justifies them busting him in his mouth and busting through the window. So we were just noting that the video that we saw is the, I think that's the body cam footage. We're going to show a different angle, which we believe is William McNeil Jr.'s own recording of what happened. And we'll roll that now.
After refusing to get out of his car, William McNeil Jr. took this open-handed blow from JSO officer Donald Bowers during a February traffic stop. Just days following the release of the footage shot on McNeil's phone, Sheriff T.K. Waters announced Bowers had been stripped of his policing authority pending the results of an ongoing internal investigation. He suggested if McNeil had filed an official complaint, the agency would have looked into the arrest earlier.
We'd have been all over it, you know, if had that been the case. But he did not.
Official JSO records, including the arrest report, the incident report, and the response to resistance report, make no mention of Officer Bauer's initial hit to McNeil's face. Police body cam also fails to capture the blow.
Ugh. So there's...
And he does it
twice.
That's
what I was going to say. There's another angle still when he gets snatched out the car where they bust his head up against... I think it's up against the car, Andrew. But it's just... It is infuriating. It is...
So four,
there were two black officers
52
there.
In the afternoon mm-hmm. at 7, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night. It's still
That's
light,
right.
by the way, right
mm-hmm.
now in where I am in Florida, right? Jacksonville's just down the street.
That's what it's, we say. That's where
before
this
place, 5 p.m. Before 5 p.m. in
on.
February, the sky, because we see the video. Mm-hmm. It's clear.
Mm-hmm.
You can, I mean, it may not be clear. It could be cloudy. I have no idea. But I don't see rain falling.
Right.
It's not on the lens of the camera, and it doesn't appear on the gentleman's vehicle either. Right. So what they actually did here, y'all, is something called a pretext stop, pretextual stop. By the way, this is something the Department of Justice has dissuaded police departments from doing. And what that means is you take a minor infraction as an opportunity to pull someone over whom you believe is involved in more serious criminal activity, and you use this pretext, this lights not on, or fail to use a signal when changing lanes, or whatever other minor infraction they could come up with, so that they can get into the vehicle and hopefully discover what are deeper crimes. The reason why the DOJ dissuades people from using pretextual stops and have written consent decrees with police departments all across the country to end this kind of practice is because generally it targets Black people and Black communities. So if you were doing pretextual stops all over the city, it was happening in white areas as well as in Black areas, it would be one thing, it'd be indiscriminate. Except almost always these pretext stops are used extremely excessively in Black communities and Black neighborhoods, Black sides of towns and on poor sides of towns as a way to get these people caught up in a much more serious infraction. They don't even pull people for weed right now in this state, pretty much, unless they consider you are a dealer. And this man's got smokable weed, and that's what you're going to say now is the reason that justifies you coming across his face like that twice unprovoked? It's insane. Again, not shocked, not surprised. I'm glad that the brother lived to tell the story another day, because I could have easily seen this situation going completely differently. And were it not for his own recording, many viewers, listeners would not have been able to see the devastation that this officer causes unprovoked by escalating the situation and not de-escalating it.
You know, it's hard to watch, but it is a regular occurrence. Yeah. And I remember when the debate around body cams were coming out, and it was this big victory, like, okay, now all police officers will wear body cams, and it hasn't really stopped or changed anything. All we have now is a better view of officers assaulting and killing us. You know, I don't know what to do. I think it's important to look at, in 2020, when there was this so-called racial reckoning, you know, I think we all kind of knew that this was just a brief marketing ploy for corporations. And it hasn't really changed much. It hasn't really had an impact. And it's why I say, like, you cannot serve the corporate structure and community, because they run contrary to each other. When all these companies were giving money, and again, this was like a blood sacrifice, you know, like we had to watch a man be murdered on TV for them to even do anything. And so when the country's 50 biggest countries, publicly traded companies, were given all this money, JP Morgan Chase, Google gave money. It was like millions of dollars pouring in. And it wasn't real structural change. Like, how much money
actually. Easiest thing they could have ever done.
Precisely.
Easiest.
But even the money they gave, more than 90% of that money was allocated to potentially profitable initiatives. Stuff like loans and investments and mortgages. The reporting found that, and I think it was the Washington Post who dug into this, the reporting found that I think only $70 million went to organizations that were devoted to criminal justice and racial justice. And in the years, I don't know the most current stats, but in the years between 2017 and 2024, 4 years after George Floyd's murder, 248 Black men have been shot to death by the police. So I, you know, like these policies, it was just a reflexive reaction to the murder of somebody, not a true racial reckoning, that we want to call it. Sorry, if you're watching this and my camera is shaky, it is because I'm trying to still play with my charger. My computer's going to die at any minute. So apologies for making the video shake, and apologies to the folks who have to deal with this in post-production and the viewers who might get vertigo watching it. But it is, Andrew, the reason why we're talking about this is because you brought up you have three children, two black boys who you're raising. And the fear it must strike in you every time. And I experienced this on the Vineyard in the summer. And you see, like, you know, the little black teenagers walking around like they hard, okay? Yeah. And they on the Vineyard, but they walking around with the pants and the hair and, you know, like, what up, dog? You know?
It's expression.
It's expression. You know, it's fine. I love to see it. I'm like, yes, black boys, be free and be joyful. You deserve that. But I look at them and I'm like, y'all are 15, 16, 17. Some of y'all I'd have known since you were 2, 3, 4, and 5. And I see you as these babies, right? These babies who have grown up. And I think you walk off this island and the world sees you as a threat. They see you as violent. Just like this boy in his car, this young man in his car was immediately perceived a threat. Do you think a white boy in khakis would have been met with that same thing? And the fact that he had marijuana on him is irrelevant. Recreational marijuana does happen to be illegal in Florida. Florida needs to get with the times, because I know all those crazy MAGA folks down there are definitely blazing and snorting and doing all kinds of things. But you can have marijuana on you if you have a medical card in Florida. They didn't even ask him, do you have a medical card for this? So I'm disgusted by it. And a part of me, again, because I'm reading Nassada, a part of me feels like, he wasn't resisting. People say, well, why are they trying to get up? It's like, because that shit hurts. You're being slammed to the ground. You're trying to protect yourself. You're trying to just be treated like a human being. But I do feel like if we are to die, then I want to die fighting, you know? Like, I just, at some point, I want them to be scared of us. At some point, I want you to be scared about putting your hands on black bodies. Because I've seen white folks get away with that. And I know, like, I want y'all to push back and tell me, like, that ain't the thing.
Yeah,
because if we will get killed. I know we will get killed. But I just, like, with George Floyd, I'm like, in that moment, I want them to be scared. I want them to feel like we surrounded by a bunch of black folks and I'm kneeling on this man's neck. Like, yeah, we got guns, but if they descend, I don't know. Just how do we tap into that Montgomery?
They murdered with impunity.
That's my point.
Because they have a license to kill.
But I think.
Well, go ahead, Angela. Legally, I'm sure I'm saying something bad.
No, I think I understand what you're saying. You know, I think that we're tired of dying, and it feels, you know, especially frustrating when your resistance is treated as the most criminal thing and not the initial reason why you were stopped or questioned or handcuffed or busted in the face, because you like, I don't understand why you're pulling me over. You're telling me to put my seatbelt on. Like, how do you know I didn't take the seatbelt off once you pulled me over to get my license out? Like, you don't really know what's going on. And I think that, let's say that he didn't have a seatbelt on. And let's say that he needed to put his lights on because there was inclement weather that only this officer could see. What purpose does it serve you to bust the window and to punch this man in the face? And then I think for me, the worst offense is these black men who are present for the stop, present for the attack, because that's what it was, present for the arrest, who are no different than the officers on the screen or the officer on the screen in Boys in the Hood. Like, you are just a part of what is wrong with with structural racism and systemic issues.
Power.
With police and law enforcement for our folks. So I'm sending William all the love, William McNeil Jr. And I just want to say, brother, I understand why you didn't file a complaint, because it's like, what difference does it make? So now they're mad at you because you didn't file a complaint. Now they're mad at you because you traumatized off of what happened. There are so many young black men who don't have video, who don't have, you know, the benefit of the doubt on their side, because maybe they committed a crime, because maybe they look to be inherently violent and criminal. Whatever it is, you don't deserve that. And you do deserve our advocacy. And so we'll shed a light on this, even if it upsets our stomach, makes us nauseous, knowing your reality. We can't imagine what you're going through, just trying to make it through. But no, you have family in us, and we are going to fight alongside you. And like I said, this might be the time Andrew brings his bullhorn back out.
I just think we need to update what we're telling our yeah. children, our young people, when they encounter law enforcement. I remember taking my kids to the park, which I did every Sunday when they were little, and we would play outside, get the energy outside, go to bed. And I remember, you know, these white women in the park, you know, bending down at my children and saying how cute they were and, oh, how polite and, oh, how this. Mm-hmm. And I remember having this just thought flushed to my mind, like, when do they become your enemies?
Yes, right.
When do they become the dangers that you fear? Mm-hmm. They're so cute now and so, you know, precocious and all these things. And I'm thinking, when do you decide that they're now the threat? Because it really is your decision. I mean, it isn't what I determine. My interaction with them is not the status quo, because I see babies. I see boys. I see kids who are being kids, who are making kid-like decisions about themselves in that moment in time. I see bright futures, incredible contributors to the future of humanity. And I'm being humble with that. That's what I see. But unfortunately, your eyes have scales on them, and it can't quite reveal the truth of the matter. And so when you decide my kids are to be feared is when I'm on hyper steroids trying to protect them, left, right, center. You mentioned I don't know my neighbors. I gotta know my neighbors. And I take my kids with me when I introduce myself to folks who are moving into the neighborhood, because I don't want them to mistake who they are when they see them walking down the street at dusk or walking back to through the neighborhood after school when they've been dropped off by a bus. Right. So we don't have the luxury of just leaving it to chance. And our kids don't have the right to be children. They must now assess every situation from its most murky point, from its most sinister perspective, because you lack the curiosity and the muscle memory to see a human as a human being, regardless of the color, melanated or not, skin they have. It's ridiculous, but I don't expect more. So we do have to do what we can to protect our children wherever we can.
Yeah. And that's a great place for us to end. Also, for those of you watching, yes, Tiff's battery finally did die, but she hung in there.
Gave out
and
on
the
this,
thing that we know.
She put up a fight, Lord.
The
she
thing that we know fight. Is the marathon continues. We will continue it. The fight, and you can continue to tune in. This is Still Y'all's Home. Welcome home, y'all.
Welcome home. Welcome home.
Native Land Pod is a production of iHeartRadio in partnership with Reason Choice Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Joining us now, founding partner of PUC, Matthew Bellany. Matt, really good to have you. Bring us behind the scenes on this deal. How explicit were the promises from Skydance to the FCC to change programming at CBS? And do we have an idea of what that is going to look like?
It's been very explicit. There have been several letters that have been filed with the FCC explicitly promising that they will monitor the content, particularly at CBS News. Obviously, the president was involved in litigation over 60 Minutes. He claims that a Kamala Harris interview was deceptively edited. The parent company of CBS, Paramount, paid $16 million to settle that lawsuit, even though most observers believed it was a bogus claim and CBS would have won that suit. But Skydance, which is taking over this company, has explicitly said we're going to have someone inside CBS News to make sure that the content is representative of a full view of viewpoints. They also are ending all the DEI programs. CBS was among the most aggressive companies in Hollywood in their DEI programs. 50% of the writers on shows at one point were designated persons of color. So this is a pretty big commitment explicitly by the new owner.
If Donald Trump wasn't the president, would Skydance be making these sort of changes at CBS?
Absolutely not. I mean, there are always conditions on the transfer of licenses for the broadcast networks, but I have never seen something that has been, I mean, the commissioner said it's been weaponized. I think Trump would agree with that assessment. He's been pretty open that he wants more favorable coverage for him. He's not hiding the agenda here. He wants it to be more favorable to him, and he was openly cheering when Stephen Colbert was canceled by CBS. Now, there are financial considerations on that decision, and Colbert's show was losing money for a long time. The entire late-night television model is changing. But the fact that the president is saying, yeah, we wanted this to happen, and then it did happen, that sends a message throughout the media community.
Yeah, it's an ugly addition to this. Let me ask you about South Park. And this is kind of the difference between South Park and Colbert here. South Park makes a ton of money, They signed a $1.5 billion deal with Paramount to continue doing the show, 50 new episodes, plus I think streaming on Paramount Plus for all of its seasons. There are 27 seasons. They have so much money, and they are now using their platform to viciously and unsparingly go after not just Paramount, but also Donald Trump. Could they get canceled?
I don't think so. And in my Puck newsletter, I reported that the decision to air that episode went all the way up to the owner of Paramount, Sherry Redstone. She knew the stakes. She knew this deal was on the one-yard line, and the FCC was about to approve it. And she said to her CEOs, I trust your judgment. If you want to run this, you can run this. South Park has a history of going after not only Donald Trump, but a lot of politicians and powerful people. They get away with a lot more because they're animated. It's not, you know, a person delivering the lines. And because of the economics of this show and how valuable it is a top 25 streaming show, I don't think they are at risk of getting canceled. Interestingly, the White House lashed out over South Park, but Trump himself has not done so. And I think it's a recognition that South Park has a lot of fans on both sides of the aisle.
Powerful. And you know what? They go after, they literally go after everybody, even in the episode that aired two nights ago. They went after liberals as well. They're unsparing for everybody. We'll see. All right, Matthew Bellany, really good to have you. Thanks for joining us today.
So many new acquisitions in the offseason. Head coach Mike Tomlin says training camp is the time when it all meshes together.
This is new territory for us. But oftentimes our interest in people is dependent upon relationships. And so they might be new to the Pittsburgh Steelers, but most of the guys that we've acquired, we've had some intimate knowledge of them as individuals and as players, and it's really liked them at earlier portions of their career at different points in the process.
We'll get to see new Steelers like Aaron Rodgers, DK Metcalf, and Jalen Ramsey all participate in team drills over the course of the next few weeks in Latrobe. In early portions, they'll follow the lead of veteran guys who have called St. Vincent home for years. Guys like TJ Watt, who just inked his three-year contract extension this week.
I just wanted the deal to get done, and obviously I'm happy it got done before training camp, just to be able to be here, to eliminate any potential distraction, to just worry about football. The goal always remains the same, and it's a new year. It's a fresh start for everybody across the league. Everybody looks good on paper this time of year, but it's all about what we do over the next week, next couple weeks here in preparation.
Covering Westmoreland County in Latrobe, Ashley Laiotis, Pittsburgh's Action Sports.
Hey there, Carnegie Mellon. It's Reed AI, the digital twin of LinkedIn co-founder Reed Hoffman here on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm here to tell you you're about to tune into Possible, a show that sketches out what's possible if we use technology like AI and our collective effort effectively. Possible is hosted by my buddy Reed Hoffman and the great Aria Finger. You might enjoy the show if you're signed up for 15281 or 15110, or if you're a Dietrich College student or alum, or maybe if you're just on a walk through the cut on the way to eat or study. Regardless, I hope you'll tune into this episode of Possible. Oh, and one last thing. The views, thoughts, and opinions in this show do not necessarily represent those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Okay, enjoy the episode and go Tartans.
AI is going to affect the whole world. It's going to be the most transformative technology ever, in my opinion. So if that's true, and it's going to be like electricity or fire, then I think it's important that the whole world participates in its design. I do actually think it's important that we get these other inputs, the broader inputs, not just the scientists, not just the tech companies, not just the scientists involved in deciding how this gets built and what it gets used for.
Hi, I'm Reid Hoffman.
And I'm Aria Finger.
We want to know how together we can use technology like AI to help us shape the best possible future.
We ask technologists, ambitious builders, and deep thinkers to help us sketch out the brightest version of the future. And we learn what it'll take to get there.
This is possible. In the 13th century, Sir Galahad embarked on a treacherous journey in pursuit of the elusive Holy Grail, the Grail, known in Christian lore as the cup Christ used in the Last Supper, had disappeared from King Arthur's table. The knights of the Round Table swore to find it. After many trials, Galahad's pure heart allowed him the unique ability to look into the Grail and observe divine mysteries that could not be described by the human tongue.
In 2020, a team of researchers at DeepMind successfully created a model called AlphaFold that could predict how proteins will fold. This model helped answer one of the holy grail questions of biology. How does a long line of amino acids configure itself into a 3D structure that becomes the building block of life itself? In October 2024, three scientists involved with AlphaFold won a Nobel Prize for these efforts. This is just one of the striking achievements spearheaded by our guest today.
Demis Hassabis is a British artificial intelligence researcher, co-founder, and CEO of the AI company DeepMind. Under his leadership, DeepMind developed AlphaGo, the first AI to defeat a human world champion in Go, and later created AlphaFold, which solved the 50-year protein folding problem. He is considered one of the most influential figures in AI.
Reid and I sat down for an interview with Demis, in which we talked about everything from game theory to medicine to multimodality and the nature of innovation and creativity.
Here's our conversation with Demis Hassabis. Demis, welcome to Possible. I think I'm going to start with a question that kind of came from your Babbage Theater lecture and also from the fireside chat that you did with Mohamed El-Erian, which is, share with us the moment where you went from thinking chess is the kind of the thing that I have, you know, spent my childhood doing, to what I want to do is start thinking about thinking. I want to accelerate the process of thinking, and that computers are a way to do that. And how did you arrive at that? What age were you? What was that turn into metacognition?
Chess for me is where it all started, actually, in gaming. And I started playing chess when I was 4, very seriously, all through my childhood, playing for most of the England junior teams, captaining a lot of the teams. And for a long while, my main aim was to become a professional chess player, you know, grandmaster, maybe one day, possibly a world champion. And that was my whole childhood, really. Every spare moment, not at school, I was playing, going around the world playing chess, you know, against adults in international tournaments. And then around 11 years old, I sort of had an epiphany, really, that although I love chess and I still love chess today, is it really something that one should spend your entire life on? Is it the best use of my mind? So that was one thing that was troubling me a little bit. But then the other thing was, as we were going to training camps with the England chess team, you know, we started to use early chess computers and to try and improve your chess. And I remember thinking that, you know, of course, we were supposed to be focusing on improving the chess openings and chess theory and tactics. But actually, I was more fascinated by the fact that someone had programmed this inanimate lump of plastic to play very good chess against me. And I was fascinated by how that was done. And I really wanted to understand that and then eventually try and make my own chess programs.
I mean, it's so funny. I was saying to Reed before this, my 7-year-old school just won the New York State Chess Championship. So they have a long way to go before they get to you. But he takes it on faith, like, oh, yeah, Mom, I'm just going to go play Chess Kid on the computer. Like, I'll go play against the computer a few games, which, of course, was sort of a revelation sort of decades ago. And I remember, you know, when I was in middle school, it was obviously the Deep Blue versus Garry Kasparov. And this was like a man versus machine moment. And one thing that you've gestured at about this moment is that it illustrated, like in this case, based on Grandmaster data, it was like brute force versus like a self-learning system. Can you say more about that dichotomy?
Yeah, well, look, first of all, I mean, it's great your son's playing chess, and I think it's fantastic. I'm a big advocate for teaching chess in schools as a part of the curriculum. I think it's fantastic training for the mind, just like doing maths or programming would be. And it certainly affected the way, you know, the way I approach problems and problem solve and visualize solutions and plan. You know, it teaches you all these amazing meta skills, dealing with pressure. So you sort of learn all of that as a young kid, which is fantastic for anything else you're going to do. And as you know, as far as Deep Blue goes, you're right. Most of these early chess programs, and then Deep Blue became the pinnacle of that, were these types of expert systems, which at the time were the favored way of approaching AI, where actually it's the programmers that solve the problem, in this case, playing chess, and then they encapsulate that solution in a set of heuristics and rules, which guides a kind of brute force search towards, you know, in this case, making a good chess move. And I always had this, although I was fascinated by these early chess programs that they could do that, I was also slightly disappointed by them. And actually, by the time it got to Deep Blue, I was already studying at Cambridge in my undergrad. I was actually more impressed with Kasparov's mind, because I'd already started studying neuroscience, than I was with the machine. Because here was this brute of a machine. All it can do is play chess. And then Kasparov can play chess at the same, sort of roughly the same level, but also can do all the other things. Amazing things that humans can do. And so I thought, isn't that, you know, doesn't that speak to the wonderfulness of the human mind? And it also, more importantly, means something was missing from very fundamental from Deep Blue and these expert system approaches to AI, right? Very clearly, because Deep Blue did not seem, even though it was a pinnacle of AI at the time, it did not seem intelligent. And what was missing was its ability to learn new things. So for example, it was crazy that Deep Blue could play chess to world champion level, but it couldn't even play tic-tac-toe, right? You'd have to reprogram. Nothing in the system would allow it to play tic-tac-toe. So that's odd, right? That's very different to a human grandmaster, who obviously play a simpler game trivially. And then also, it was not general, right, in the way that the human mind is. And I think those are the hallmarks. That's what I took away from that match, is those are the hallmarks of intelligence, and they were needed if we wanted to crack AI.
And go a little bit into the deep learning, which obviously is part of